Increase our faith, the apostles asked Jesus. Now, if you look up a dictionary, you will find faith defined in two contexts. One in a general way, as to have complete trust or confidence in something or someone, such as this restores one's faith in politicians. The other one in a religious way, as to have belief, even a strong belief, in the doctrines of a religion based on spiritual conviction rather than proof. Well, come with me, if you will, for a moment back in the mists of time to when I attended Sunday school over there behind me in the halls in Abbey Park Place. Each Sunday, when we were in the big Sunday school, we were expected to come prepared, having learned and being able to recite a part of the shorter catechism, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Well, if you're not, maybe I could remind you. The shorter catechism is a teaching method of question and answer. There are over 100 questions, each with a given set answer. If my memory is distinctly hazy about what came after, I can always remember the first. The first question, do you remember? What is the chief end of man? No inclusive language, of course, in 1647 when the catechism was drawn up. You'll appreciate it was a year or two later that I was in the Sunday school. What is the chief end of man? The answer to which is, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. I like the sound of that. I liked it then and I still like it now. Other questions are, what is sin? How does Christ execute the office of a priest? What are the benefits which in this life do accompany or flow from justification, adoption, and sanctification? Which was, of course, a question right at the front of my 9-year-old mind. The Catechism includes 40 questions about the Ten Commandments and 10 about the Lord's Prayer. It was based on contemporary 17th century Reformed theology, but however soundly based it may be doctrinally, I can honestly say that for me, the Catechism did little or nothing to engender faith. Looking back to that time, a much more important influence was attending worship here, particularly the celebration of Holy Communion. Children were then not allowed to take part in the sacrament, and the few children who did come were required to sit and watch the service from the gallery. I was always transfixed by the service. The liturgy and the actions of the sacrament spoke more meaningfully and deeply to me of the nature of God than any catechism did then, or any doctrinal statement or confession of faith have themselves ever done since. The wonder of the sacraments is that their actions reach where words never can. The saying that faith is caught, not taught, would apply to me, and I suspect to many others as well. I caught faith through community, through being involved in the worship of the faith community, especially through the sacraments of baptism and communion. That, I believe, is how still our children will also be helped to find faith, through taking part in worship, including fully in the sacrament of Holy Communion, which I'm glad to say has been possible now for a number of years. There is no level of acquired knowledge, no intellectual prerequisite that can be set for admitting a person, whatever their age, to participate in the central act of Christian worship. It is through taking part that faith is sensed and nourished. There have been other influences, of course, in my faith development. Inspirational people, and not always religious people, who lived out their faith in service, commitment, and self-denial, and even sacrifice. There have been personal and shared life experiences which have led me to reflect about the meaning of life, an ongoing process that inevitably affects faith. So faith evolves, changes, develops as we interact with life, with others, and with God. As our following hymn says, the roads of faith are born of myth and story, woven from life and many human dreams. It wasn't just Jesus' teaching, it was his demeanor. It was the way he related to individuals and their needs that attracted people to him. The best way I can describe it is to say Jesus must have had winsomeness. People, ordinary people, were drawn to him, were attracted to him by his humanity and his integrity. In trying to encapsulate what Jesus' life meant for creation and for humankind, the author of John's Gospel said, "The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. God so loved the world that he gave us his Son." Looking back, the church would see the resurrection as the endorsement of faith, of the worth and of the trust God puts in us, in humankind, through that risky engagement in the affairs of the world. Through the Word made flesh and subsequently through the living Spirit of God forever active, God's love is made flesh, celebrated, proclaimed, and lived out in every age and time in this world. For me, that is the basis of whatever faith I now have. For me, faith is not an ecstatic state that gives an inner warm glow and assures me that all will be well. That has not been my faith experience. Neither is faith for me, as I read recently, if you believe God, he will do it. He will keep you from going bankrupt. He will keep food on your table and clothes on your back. He will help you in your business and in your job. God will do it when you ask him in faith and in the name of Jesus. How could such a self-centered desire for prosperity and personal well-being possibly have anything to do with what Jesus was all about? Rather, I would say that God has in Christ shown his faith in us, in me, in all of us, in his creation and his creatures, and I am part of that. I am part of God's faith in humankind being worked out in my time, in our times, in times to come. I am part of the faith continuum, what the church calls the communion of saints. Now, all of this doesn't assure me of a charmed life. It doesn't guarantee anything other than I believe that in the totally inadequate efforts of a flawed life, I, and indeed any one of us, can nevertheless be part of that mystery of God alive and at work in this world. I find these words describing faith more helpful. Faith is about the love of God through Christ. Faith is about being grasped by Christ so that you know in your heart and bones that your life and his life and the life of the world are mixed together. Once that happens, you see yourself and your neighbor and your world completely new. Once that happens, you know that the only thing that matters is that love and that the only reality is grace. Once that happens, you can forgive because you are a new creation and therefore you see everyone else as a new creation. So the disciples asked Jesus to increase their faith. But what brought that on? Set in the context of Luke's gospel, the apostles' plea comes immediately after some challenging words of Jesus about forgiving. Even if your brother wrongs you 7 times a day and comes back to you 7 times saying, "I am sorry," you are to forgive him. They were asking Jesus to increase their faith in order to be able to forgive in the challenging way presented to them by Jesus. Forgiveness is an act of faith. It reflects God's faith in us and the faith we have to have in each other, otherwise life becomes unbearable. Faith, then, is a relational thing and leads to action. It's a verb. It's not about subscribing to a creed, but about acting in love. And this is reflected in Jesus' response to the apostles. It's not about believing something, it's about action. If you had faith no bigger than a mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, "Be uprooted and replanted in the sea," and it would at once obey you. In both Matthew's and Mark's Gospels, it's not the deep-rooted mulberry tree, but a mountain that is moved by faith. Now, we've not to take this rooting up and throwing into the sea literally, of course, because no one has done so as evidence of faith. The saying is surely hyperbole, a device from his Hebrew tradition by which Jesus emphasizes his point. He was saying that by faith we can do the difficult, the unexpected, and the unlikely, even if it seems impossible. He was affirming to the ones that he had chosen to carry the message of God's love, that they had faith, even if it seemed to them as small as a mustard seed. That was neither a disadvantage nor an excuse. It was no more than was needed. It was more than enough for each to do what each was capable of. And as Paul would remind the church, if I have all faith as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. Love never ends. So there is faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. Faith then is a verb, it's about doing, it's belief in action. As followers of Christ, that means love in action. And this is to be no wishy-washy sentimental love, but a love that seeks the good of the other without expecting anything in return, an altruistic love, a self-denying love, a gutsy love. Like the catechism, the prophet Micah, we heard, asked, "And what does the Lord require of you?" And the answer he gave was, "To do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God." And all we need is, according to Jesus, faith no bigger than a mustard seed. In other words, whatever faith we have, that's enough. This is mustard seed faith, the faith of love in action, the faith that is prepared to put just one foot in front of the other at a time, one small step at a time, and then take another and another. Small steps of faith, small mustard seeds of faith that can hurl trees into the sea and move mountains, trees of prejudice and mountains of bigotry, trees of injustice and mountains of vengeance, trees of hate and mountains of intolerance, trees of oppression and mountains of fear. Faith no bigger than a mustard seed. The Wild Boars football team appeared at a press conference last Wednesday. They hadn't won the World Cup, but as you know, they'd won the world's hearts. It was an event that many thought would never happen. As you're no doubt aware, the team and their coach were cut off on the 23rd of June after the heavy rains flooded the cave complex that they had been exploring, blocking their way back out. It was 9 days later, on the 2nd of July, that they were actually found huddled together in darkness on a ledge some 2.5 miles from the cave's mouth. The group had survived, as you know, by drinking water dripping from the cave walls and saving that energy by meditating. Elation at the discovery of the group quickly turned to concern as it became clear just how difficult it was going to be to rescue the boys, none of whom could swim and all of whom had been weakened by their underground experience. It seemed hopeless, an impossible task. Many saw no happy outcome. So what do you do when fate seems to be delivering such a terrible conclusion? Give in? Stand around waiting and dithering? There was only a tiny bit of hope, but that's all we had to work with, and in the end, that tiny bit of hope became reality. That's the English translation of the words, the head of the Thai Navy SEALs after the successful rescue of the 12 boys from the cave and their coach. That tiny bit of hope. We might say that mustard seed of faith was enough to make them decide to act. It took the Thai-led international team of divers several days to set up the rescue operation. Eventually on Sunday, the 8th of July, more than 2 weeks after the floods had stranded them, the first four boys were successfully brought out. The first part of the journey, as you know, required wading and diving through flooded passages. Next came a one-mile climb over slippery rock with ropes as assistance. And there was, of course, that dangerous part, a pinch of only 15 inches wide. The whole 2.5 miles took 9 hours to complete. Four more boys were brought out on Monday, with the last four and their coach being rescued on Tuesday the 10th after an 8-hour journey. Understandably, there was widespread jubilation and high levels of admiration for the dedication, courage, tenacity and skills of all the divers involved and the rescue team. But sorrow too at the loss of Saman Gunan, a former Thai Navy diver who lost his life delivering air tanks to the cave. One of the British divers, Rick Stanton, involved, eschewed the idea of being a hero, telling reporters, "This was completely uncharted, unprecedented territory, and nothing like this has been done before." So, of course, there were doubts. I knew that we had a good team with good support from the Thai authorities, the caving community and rescue organizations, so we had the best we could do to make a plan work. The Navy Thai SEALs involved wrote on Facebook, "We are not sure if this is a miracle, science, or what." Perhaps the leader came near an answer with these words I've already quoted. "There was only a tiny bit of hope, but that's all we had to work with. And in the end, that tiny bit of hope became reality." Faith, hope, no bigger than a mustard seed. That rescue began with a mustard seed of faith and hope, but found expression in love, in risky, selfless action, in the courage, dedication, endurance, skill of all those involved, and with one paying the ultimate price. Their combined effort is surely a wonderful antidote to the pessimism and cynicism about humankind that sometimes seems to dominate our world. So often the focus is on the negative and the gloomy, when in so many measurable ways, the opposite is the case if we will only look. The rescue of the Wild Boars football team and their coach reminds us of what humankind can achieve, even with only a mustard seed of faith and hope. I think we might actually say in this case that the rescuer's mustard seed of faith effectively moved a mountain. Thanks be to God.